The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com.
Today is Wednesday. It's October 2nd, 2024, and it's 2:43 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends and listen to me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Burr from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
I'm Marge Halperin. I draw on decades of experience as a journalist, a communications professional, a government reform worker, and doing what I can with activism and Indivisible Chicago and an old neighborhood group called One Community Near South, trying to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, challenging authority and trying to change the world at the same time. I'm multitasking.
That wraps up all the time we have for the podcast this week. Thanks for dialing in.
Wait, there's more.
So I've decided, guys, that debates do not serve the purpose of informing the public. I don't suppose that's breaking news. And that's also not to say that they can't be consequential or persuasive. J.D. Vance helped his ticket in the vice presidential debate last night, but he did so by outmaneuvering Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. You did not come away with a realistic or better sense of what's wrong with our country. You did get J.D. Vance's version of reality and of Donald Trump. The Wall Street Journal said that his version of Trump was actually better than the real one, one the Journal said they hardly recognized in Vance's telling of it. So who won the debate? Fine, Vance did. He was better at skipping past the truth than Walz was in delivering it. So, like millions of Americans, after about 45 minutes, I turned off the debate and watched Phantom Thread on my Peloton. Did you guys stay through the entire debate last night? Austin, did you watch Phantom Thread on your Peloton last night?
I watched. That's a really funny combo of activities. I watched the whole debate. I would say it's definitely more lively than Phantom Thread, depending on Phantom Thread is a slow burn. I think it's an amazing movie, but that's
great,
not
movie,
exactly
though.
Fireworks at every turn. It's like a brooding, you know, psychological drama.
So, yeah.
I watched the whole thing, and for people, I think a lot of people probably turned it off halfway through. And in that sense, I think Vance won by even more, because his worst moment by far was his response on January 6th, which didn't come till the very end of the debate. I believe that said, I think also Tim Walz's worst answer on Tiananmen, that came in the second half, right? Is that correct?
I did see that in real time. So that might have been more towards the middle, more front.
Maybe towards the middle.
I think that was kind of towards the beginning, really.
It was such an easy question to answer.
That was one of the worst responses to a debate question by a politician that I've ever seen, period.
Yeah.
And I think otherwise the debate was like kind of to a draw, besides that low moment from Vance and the very low moment from Walz. So the first half, I think Vance certainly did better. I think for conservatives, the chatter that I was hearing was, in terms of his answer on the question of abortion, that is the best people on the right have heard a politician on the right talk about that issue in a way that is not alienating to the rabid pro-life base, while also not alienating swing voters. That's not to say that what he said was an honest representation of his position or the position of the party or the position of Donald Trump, but purely from a communications angle, I think on that issue and several others, he did really, really well. And I think he introduced the nation to his personal story in a compelling way. And he did what Donald Trump couldn't do, which was stay on a consistent message of why did this administration not do the things it's promising. He repeated that throughout the entire debate, which I thought was good. Tim Walz came across, I think, as pretty likable, but had a couple of, I think especially fair to Vance, but just had a couple of moments that were just a little bit too big for him. One was the Tiananmen Square thing, and then also just sort of his his general demeanor had a couple of deer in the headlights.
The whole time he looked angry and unsettled, and Vance was so cool, calm, and collected. Marge, you were kind of making a face when Austin brought up the abortion positioning. What's the matter?
Well, I don't think women's ears heard it quite the same way you did, Austin. He started by mentioning this friend of his who had had an abortion because she was in an abusive relationship. Rather gratuitously, love ya. I know you're listening, you know, like this personal outreach. Well, if she was listening, she didn't hear anything that would help her at all. In fact, it was the biggest, to me, missed opportunity for Walls. He should have come right back and said, wait a minute, does your friend who had an abortion because of an abusive relationship know that you have said repeatedly that women should stay in abusive relationships for the good of the children? And how does she feel about your position overall on abortion, as you've stated repeatedly? There wasn't anything I would have said that you said that would make her or any other women more likely to trust you. His answer infuriated me. I don't know what you heard, Austin, but he wasn't speaking to women there.
Well, I think that's a gross overgeneralization. It's not like I think if the gender splits on the presidential campaign, certainly Kamala is winning women, but it's not as though Trump and J.D. Vance don't have a... I am not one of those supporters of Trump and J.D. Vance, but it's not as if they don't have female supporters. So I think for people who already dislike J.D. Vance, that's a horror. It's going to be a horrible answer, whatever he says on abortion. But I do think from a pure communications perspective on an issue that Republicans have been absolutely awful on in terms of policy and rhetoric, it was actually a big improvement on rhetoric is the point I was making there.
Kate, did you have a almost visceral reaction like Marge did to that part of the debate, or what perked your ears?
Well, as far as Vance is concerned, because he is so very unpopular, right? The most unpopular vice presidential candidate apparently in all of modern times.
Second most unpopular ever. I don't know who number two is. I don't know. I was scratching my head about that. I heard that stat thrown out this week, and they said he was the second most unpopular vice presidential candidate of all time. And I can't even think of that many vice presidential candidates, let alone unpopular
Dan
ones.
Quayle, maybe?
Well, yeah, I was wondering.
Agnew.
It's Pete Zimmerman. That's weird.
Our producer,
nice,
Pete.
Nice, Austin.
Sarah Palin?
Oh, yeah. Nice. Well, she was both, though.
Yeah,
she
probably,
was
probably Sarah Palin, right?
She was
right.
Wildly popular and done. Go ahead, Kate.
We've been seeing on, certainly on cable news and on social media, we've been seeing lots of clips of J.D. Vance speaking at rallies, but also in interviews where he can really get very ugly and personal in his attacks on Tim Walz and Kamala Harris, and maybe not as crazy as Trump. So I think a lot of people, just the fact that he was able to project calmness, being the mature, kind of grown up in the room, reasonable persona throughout the entire thing. He really never completely lost his cool about anything. That alone probably won him a bid. In fact, the CNN poll immediately afterward did have him winning. He definitely, I think, would have made a lot of people who are on the fence, but maybe like leaning toward Trump, but a little worried about him, might have made them feel a little bit better about voting for Donald Trump.
He helped
Trump
the ticket, I would say.
He had this weird ability to sort of mouth basic Trumpian positions while being really kind of the opposite of Trump in every way, young, religious, truly religious, and like a real family man. Just the weird opposite of Trump in every way. And that in itself worries me.
yeah, right. I mean, he even seems smarter than Trump.
I don't want them to win. And I find it really kind of scary that he could do such an amazing job of that when we know he, not all that long ago, was extremely anti-Trump. So he is truly able to mask his real opinions.
Whatever they are. I don't understand how he gets away with it, too. The answer he consistently gives to why did you change your views is because he was believing what the mainstream media used to feed him. I think that's thin. You know, none of this makes any sense, but that's the key, and he turns that, and then they all move on. I don't know how you challenge that, but that just strains credulity, if you ask me. Because the only other reasonable explanation is that he's just a chameleon, and he's latched onto Trump because that'll further his own desires for power.
And that's the answer. That's absolutely the answer. And you know, I'm not naive about politicians. I expect politicians to continually change positions, but this seems like an extreme turnaround considering how anti-Trump he was for a while, and it's just kind of scary to see how well he can do it.
Yeah, he was real. I thought he was really good in terms of just the presentation. A friend of mine who writes for Variety referred to it as Reagan-esque, that he was able to sort of put a sunny gloss on on a lot of his points. Couple of things. The Tiananmen Square thing that we've alluded to, I don't think we've explained that exactly for those who didn't listen, that Walls had claimed to have been either in Tiananmen Square or in China during the Tiananmen Square protests when he was not. And I don't know when he made this claim, but it was not true, and he was confronted with this. Like, why would you say you were in China when this happened when you weren't there for several months after that? And Austin's correct that his answer was mealy-mouthed and unpersuasive.
You actually didn't travel to Asia until August of that year. Can you explain that discrepancy?
Yeah, well, and to the folks out there who didn't get at the top of this, look, I grew up in small rural Nebraska, town of 400, town that you rode your bike with your buddies till the streetlights come on.
The question was, can you explain the discrepancy?
Just, all I said on this was, is I got there that summer and misspoke on this. So I will just, that's what I've said. So I was in Hong Kong and China during the democracy protests, went in. And from that, I learned a lot.
Basically, it amounts to the same misrepresentation or lie that he told about carrying weapons of war at some point when he was in the National Guard, or that he had been in, suggested he had been in battle, that he was just trying to make himself seem more important than he was. And you know, he called himself, a knucklehead or something like that? He admitted to being a knucklehead. But when you're caught like that, I think you just have to say, I mean, what can you say? You're a politician. You can't say, yeah, I just lied to you about that. And I was trying to make myself look better. But, you know, that's...
Well, he gave all the context, but he never gave the admission. Like, if in front of that long story about him working with kids and taking athletes and dancers over to China and doing cultural exchanges, that's all good, and that's what you were doing there. But just in the beginning, say, I shouldn't have said that. It wasn't true. I was getting too egotistical about myself, and I put myself in a more important position than I was. Here's what really happened. But he didn't do that part.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I think it pales next to the lies that Trump tells, and it also pales next to the lies that Vance told from the podium last night about abortion. I feel like Walls here and in other places in the debate, he did miss an opportunity to talk about the fact that. They say they don't want a national abortion ban, but if you have a 15-week limit or a national limit of 15 weeks or maybe a national limit of 6 weeks, it's not a ban, but it is a national abortion law that goes against their statement that they want to have state by state deciding this. And Walls needed to pivot and say, this is not an issue that I want voters deciding. I don't want some farmer in Montana deciding whether a woman in Helena gets to have an abortion. That's not his business. It's not the voters' business. That was the point that he kind of made, but he didn't come back strongly on that. And I think there were other instances where Walls fouled off some pitches. Right, I
mean, he didn't swing that's a good way to put it.
But he just didn't take some opportunities. That said, you look at the Snap polling. CBS also did a snap poll. CNN did, and they both, it looked like it didn't move the needle that much.
I'm surprised to see these polls. I thought it was devastating. It wasn't Biden Trump, but it wasn't good.
It
I said there were
you
parts
thought it
of
was the, devastating against Vance? Or?
No, I thought Vance was terrific. Somebody described the debate.
A little bit more with you on that, though, John.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I think it was absolutely devastating for him, but I did have some buyer's remorse on Walls myself, even though I could not make the purchase.
You're going to throw him out as a result of that?
I had a little buyer's remorse.
The Democrats are great at swapping out chairs. Throw somebody else in there then. Get another governor.
Right, but what I don't understand is I see him at so many political rallies. He's always, as he calls himself, the happy warrior, and he's been doing great as the happy attack dog, going hard at Trump and Vance. And I knew I had sort of heard that he himself said he wasn't so good at debates, but I didn't take that seriously.
I know. I was thinking about that.
Politics for about 20 years. He's in his second term as governor. Look at how great he is at all these rallies. I was shocked at his demeanor for the first, I think, close to half hour at least.
Well, let me suggest
his
this.
His eyes were like this.
Yeah.
It was making me nervous. It was like Abbott and Costello go to the vice presidential debate. It was really strange, especially the shots of him watching Vance give his answers in that time period.
Yeah, yeah.
Way too reminiscent. Of the Biden-Trump debate.
Well, Kamala was so studied about all of that. I'm just wondering what Austin was thinking about this observation, and that is he struck me as a game show host who's really – or contestant who's really smart, but now they kind of freeze up. Like, you knew he had all of that in the back of his head, and he'd got some studied attack lines, and he knew the back stories, but – he kind of froze in the moment.
What was interesting is that Waltz is the kind of candidate who really thrives in a rally type setting, in a friendly setting. There's few people who perform better than him. I'd say he's like above replacement level on that.
Yeah.
In a contentious setting, he was clearly pretty uncomfortable and didn't know how to treat Vance,
yeah.
Which when you have someone like Vance who is coming in with where voters have a very clear perception of him, you need to triple down on that and hammer it every single time. And instead of doing that, he totally fell into what Vance was trying to do, which was Vance is like, I'm an everyman. I'm a very relatable person. I can speak plainly and simply about these issues. That whole riff about the experts versus common sense wisdom was
unbelievable,
really good. Waltz clearly was thinking, I'm here to badmouth Trump, but there's so much fodder and ammo that you could use on Vance, and he used almost none of it. So conversely, Vance does very poorly in friendly settings. I think he does very poorly in like a pep rally type setting. He does very poorly with a friendly interview where he's like really going off on
or a donut shop like when he walks into the donut shop.
Yes.
He can't talk
to
people.
Or donut shop, like life stuff. However, in contentious settings, he's extremely good. And you've seen that in media interviews with him that are somewhat contentious. He'll do a lot of interviews and he'll handle himself pretty well and be able to flip the tables on people. So it's just a very stark difference in their strengths, I think.
Well, first of all, I don't think that he did as badly as the panel seems to think that he did. I thought that he got off some good lines. I mean, I know he did. He fouled off a bunch of pitches, as I said. There were things that he missed. I literally think Vance did a better job stagecraft-wise and all that. But I think that he did okay in terms of that. One bit of analysis that I have been hearing, and I think I subscribe to, is that it has been a mistake for Walls, particularly, to hold himself out of tougher interviews. That Walls and Harris have basically decided to sort of go around the media for the most part. Now, Harris has done some one-on-ones, but not nearly as many as Trump has. And I know Trump does them all, mostly with Fox, and he turned down 60 Minutes. Trump did, but Vance in particular has been subjecting himself to tougher interviews and sort of sharpening his message. And Tim Walls has not. And it showed last night. I thought that he was not ready with the right answers. He hadn't workshopped these answers correctly, and I guess they had done some mock debates. But he didn't. He missed some opportunities, and I think that if this were extremely consequential, there'd be a lot of hair pulling going on, and people very upset about this on the Democratic side. I think that this debate will will vanish into history because there were not any "you're no Jack Kennedy" moments, or deer in the headlights moments like Biden had. It was, you know, Walz had a worse debate than Vance. People who were thinking about voting for Trump but weren't sure about Vance, I don't know how many dozens of people there might be like that out there, were probably swayed. but this is Trump versus Harris still. And I don't think that it's going to change the polls at all. It's going to improve Vance's popularity or approval ratings, but it's not going to change the shape of the race, I don't think.
There were moments where I thought that all Walz has to say is Kamala wasn't the president. She didn't.
Yeah.
Although at the same time, they want her to take credit for the administration's successes. So you can't have it both ways. But there were times where J.D. Vance was blaming the housing crisis on Kamala Harris. And I thought, how did she screw that up, too? Could you explain that to me? Oh, the migrants are taking all the $400,000 homes? I didn't know that.
Does nobody here watch Veep? how feckless the vice president
okay.
is?
I think the key word you used, John, was chameleon. I was talking to a friend who lives in Columbus, Ohio, who called me sort of in a panic this morning and said, I assure you that J.D. Vance is not the J.D. Vance we see in Ohio. He posed as somebody else in this debate to counter his reputation, and it seemed to work. I don't know why Walz didn't call that out. I was hoping for a moment of almost humor, like especially at that moment where he complained, I didn't know we were going to fact check. I thought we weren't going to fact check. The quick answer, although they were about to cut off their microphones, but he had another chance later, is does that translate to, I thought I could just lie relentlessly because that's what you've been doing? You didn't know you were going to have a fact check? There were some things they could have prepared for. Like, wait a minute, who is this guy? Yeah, I've seen him on the campaign trail yelling and angry and where the hell is this and all the language you use and attacking women as childless cat ladies. What happened to that guy? What'd you do with him? You know, they should have been prepared for what they were going to see. And instead, as I think you also said, John, the way he just kept looking fixed his eyes on Vance, clearly he didn't recognize him, but he didn't say anything about it. And he didn't have a resting positive face.
Yeah, yeah. RPF, is that what you're calling that?
Yeah, because, you know, RPF. There's kind of resting
yes.
face. But he just a little bit of a smile playing on his lips.
Well,
instead.
Austin said that he thought a good moment for Vance was when he said, we don't believe in experts. And I thought that was jaw-dropping. I get the idea let's just use good old common sense because we're just a bunch of good old boys here. But I thought, wait a minute. Like Walz said, if I have a heart problem, I want to go to the Mayo Clinic. And there was J.D. Vance doubling down on, we don't believe the economic experts. We don't believe the scientific experts. We don't believe the foreign policy experts. He said that Donald Trump had the courage and wisdom to use common sense. And I thought, we're screwed. That's the exact opposite of how you should marshal the intellectual forces of a society. That's so stupid.
Walz said, common sense is not that common. Drinking
they used to think the earth was flat.
High-powered lights.
Yeah, exactly. No one. Austin, defend yourself.
I thought that was weak also.
I think this has been the change in Republican Party politics over the last 10 years is that it's a revolt against elites. It's a populist movement. The elites are the people who took all these great manufacturing jobs away from the Rust Belt for globalization. The elites are people who are pushing racial and gender ideology that alienates white men. Those are expert opinions, and the experts have done nothing for you, person in exurban Pennsylvania. They hate you, and I am defending you. So everything Vance said in that debate and everything he has said for the last since becoming Trump's running mate is in the spirit of that populism. And you see it reflected in their economic populism, which is shared by both parties and is crazy, which is this whole like mercantilist, protectionist, tariff based, you know, trade policy. You see it in one of the debate moments that I thought was very good was kind of tilting the scales a little bit, but or it was kind of like
I don't know how to phrase this. It was like making the moderators too much the stars of the show, but they said, hey, your plan creates a $1.7 trillion deficit. And Mr. Vance, you know, your plan creates like a $4 trillion deficit. That both parties said they're not going to do anything to Social Security. They're not going to do anything to Medicare. Like, these entitlements are, Trump's not going to touch entitlements. They say all these things. And that's all in service of this populist attitude, which I think is in the long term bad for the country, but is politically convenient and has actually been successful for Republicans in that they are gaining large shares of Hispanic and to a lesser extent Black voters with that message.
Even if it is in fact going to raise the prices, I mean, it's not going to get them houses. It's not going to lower the price of goods. The stuff that's built in China that's sold at Walmart, if you get that made in Pennsylvania, you think that's going to be cheaper? I don't love that, by the way, but that's just the reality of it. The Mincing Rascals have more to say about a few other topics of local interest, but first, let's send you to Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere, surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails. Ottawa's a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some real fall relaxation. Settle down, snuggle up in one of their nearly 400 rooms. They've got established hotels and resorts and private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, back to the Rascals now. On the city's northwest side, there's a large park and green space called Gompers Park. A few unhoused people pitched tents there, and now the population's grown to more than 25 tents. The residents near this 40-acre recreation bird sanctuary wetland trail area say it's not only unsightly, it's starting to feel unsafe, and they want the city to move these people out. The city says they don't have the money or a place to put them. Eric, is that close to you? You're on the northwest side. Are you familiar with Gompers Park?
Oh, yeah. It's a couple miles from our house. My son played youth baseball up there for several seasons. It's a really nice park. It's like sort of two parks, one on each side of Foster there. I understand very much why people in that neighborhood would be alarmed and upset about a tent city in their park. I get that. When you're living at a distance from it, as I am living at a distance from it, I guess, it's easy to say that they should be compassionate and understand that these people are unhoused and they need a place to stay, and they I'm sure most of them don't mean any harm and so on. But when you're actually living right around them and you feel like your kids can't go play in the park and you feel like it's unsanitary or whatever the other problems with it are, that it is disturbing to you. It does seem to me that the city that was able to absorb all those migrants that came in by the bus should be able to find shelter space for, what did we say, 25 tents worth of people? What's that, 50, 75 people at the most there? That they ought to be able to find safe, clean housing for them if they were able to absorb as many migrants as they did.
It is strange when you think about the fact that the city has been closing shelters. So because the migrant crisis, of course, has wound down at least for now. But at the neighborhood meeting that they just had for this, for the people regarding Gompers Park, the city said that they have spent $70 million of federal homeless money in the past year. I think they said mostly on migrants. I could be wrong about that. And that they simply don't have anything left. I agree with you, Eric. It really seems strange. With the fact that the migrant crisis has wound down, you would think they would be able to take this group of people and move them into something. And I know that there were people at that neighborhood meeting who said they were disturbed that their neighbors were not more concerned about the people in the camps than they are about potential safety of the park, for instance. I think you made a good point, Eric, that if you live farther away from the park, it's not your park, it's easy to poo-poo their concerns. The fact is there does tend to be more drug use, more mental illness in homeless encampments. In fact, the city admitted that they were coming more often, meaning every other week, they said, because there's been an uptick in problems.
Yeah, you're right, Kate, that it is complex in terms of the mental health issues, especially that are involved. But somebody in an encampment does not necessarily want a house. They're not necessarily willing to go to brick and mortar. Right. Obviously, they could go to shelters, night shelters. There's reasons why they don't. And I think, and some shelters, at least in the past, did not accept, you know, they accept families, but not single men, or there's regulations like mm-hmm. that. But they don't necessarily want to go. So it's not entirely likely that the city doesn't even try, but they can go talk to folks and they don't all want to go. What they might need more is mental health care, drug services, addiction services that they may or may not feel ready for now. That doesn't mean the city should just let people camp wherever they choose. But that has been why we've had for years these intractable sites more in my neighborhood at Congress and the highway and elsewhere. We still don't have a comprehensive service program.
What do you have in your neighborhood? What does it look like there?
Well, they cleared it out. I have to say I haven't gone over there in the last maybe 2 weeks or so, but Alderman Conway was pushing to have it cleared out, and I believe they did. But for a long time, what they were doing is, and I haven't been there lately, so I don't know if they're back or where they are, but the city provided porta potties and some structures there for people who just weren't going to leave. No matter what the options were.
I just don't understand. It's, you know, as a homeowner, I have a mortgage on a piece of property and then I'm allowed to live there. I don't understand the idea that you can just take the space on a sidewalk under Lakeshore Drive at Wilson and say, I live here now. That's not your property. And it is dangerous, or it's frightening to people. And similarly, I feel that way about these parks where you are spoiling the view. I mean, the park is there for a reason and a purpose, and this isn't that. So you're kind of wrecking the park. I place humanity higher than I do my view of a park, but I just don't understand how these people have squatters' rights. And I don't know where we're going to put them, but I think the city is completely within its rights to move people away from an area that the locals, because the locals don't want them there. I'm okay with that. I think that sounds unsympathetic. I know some people will outright refuse the kind of help that a city or the Salvation Army could offer, but at some point that's on them. I just don't think you have to let them stay there.
Well, I think the reason that some of these people do not want to go to these overnight shelters is that, first of all, they're temporary and they have their belongings with them. They've got to move from place to place, and they're kicked out early in the morning sometimes and not allowed back in till later, and that their belongings aren't safe and they don't feel safe in some of those overnight shelters. I think obviously there are always going to be some people who have mental problems who do not want to be inside at all, who would rather sleep under a viaduct. But I think my guess is that most of these people would like clean, safe housing for themselves, that if you could find single-room occupancy for them, that they would want that. I don't think it's like that they're all just campers. I think they would all prefer that. I do resonate with this sanitation issue. You know, you've got people living out there. They need clean water. They need, you know, toilet facilities. They probably need showers, all those sorts of things. Maybe they're using the park field house. I'm not sure what's going on up there. But it also doesn't seem unreasonable to me for parks to have a curfew. I think the park in my neighborhood has a posted curfew. You're not supposed to be there, I think, after 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And it doesn't seem unreasonable to say, no, you can't stay here in our parks. It's a tough problem, and it's one that, frankly, can only be solved with money.
It does seem like the city is already spending enough or has a big enough budget for homelessness that it really should be able to do something for people in these encampments.
Find another piece of real estate. I mean, literally, I don't know where that would be, and I don't mean some barren wasteland, but if you had to designate an area for people who want to live in tents, create an encampment that is maybe with some services, but I think that should be then at the city's choosing. You could relocate them there.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad idea, John. I just said that this reminds me of some of the pushback that we heard, especially from the Black community, when the city invested so much in the migrants that were being resettled here. They're like, we have a huge problem that has not been addressed of the people who are already Chicago residents. Maybe they don't have a formal address, but they still reside here. And the city, now that the migrant situation has been calmed and for the most part, they have been taken care of and given places to live, we still don't have a problem for these homeless folks. And I wonder, I feel like there could be a place, a solution. Yeah. So I do mean that. I'm thinking about, there's a man in my neighborhood who stands every day, he sits outside a gas station car wash and dries your windows for a couple bucks, right? Dries your car. If you walk by, you can give him $5 or $10 every now and then. And I've been sort of friendly with him. And one day, my husband and I were walking during the summer down to Chinatown for a festival. We walk under a viaduct, and there he is. And he's like, oh, friends, this is where I live. I live here. And he's under a viaduct with a whole lot of other people, and that was his community. And he had a sense of, this is where I live. Like, mm-hmm. He had a sense of ownership of it. I don't want to say pride exactly, but
he wasn't ashamed of it.
He wasn't ashamed, no.
Does it bother you when there's a guy like that in front of our Walgreens, and if you go in and out of the Walgreens, you have to decide every time, are you going to give this guy a buck or not? And at some point, that's not a pleasant – it's a reason to go to a different Walgreens. That's not an annoyance to you, a daily little hurdle you've got to mentally get past, Marge?
Oh, it is. Sometimes we walk around the block instead of walking down that
street. Isn't that funny? I'll bet every neighborhood has one or two of those, and you know where they're going to be. And this is stupid, but if the person can show up to that job regularly, why is it they don't take another job regularly? Do you have an explanation or thought about that?
Well, I don't think other kinds of jobs would match this man's lifestyle.
It's understandable that a lot of the people who live in homeless encampments, they consider that safer. They know the other people. That's obviously a big improvement over being shuttled in and out of shelters.
Austin, do you have a solution to this?
I've talked a lot with people in the city of Austin, Texas, around the time of Bring Chicago Home, because there's this sort of this pervasive model of housing first, which is you can't worry about treatment, you can't worry about jobs, you got to just give people housing first. And I think for a number of reasons that's the wrong approach, and people in Washington State especially have been realizing that and pushing back and doing a lot of different types of work for people who are unhoused, and the city of Austin, Texas has done so as well. I will say on the Austin, Texas front, two things I think are important that they've done. One is making it much easier to build different kinds of housing that are more accessible for people who are literally coming off the street. And one really, really interesting experiment that's been going on there is a village for formerly homeless people that is 3D printed tiny homes. Mm-hmm. So they're like 400 square foot tiny houses. It's in a village. It's a total community. It has pretty nice amenities. I think you have to sign an agreement saying, you know, XYZ, I will do XYZ in order to live here. The rent is almost nothing. And it's been really, really successful in getting people off the street. The other thing in Austin, and this was actually a referendum that was approved by voters, is that you really do have to have a zero tolerance policy for people indefinitely camping in public areas. Because if you allow it, the longer you allow it to persist, the worse it gets and the harder it gets to solve. And even near Gompers Park, I remember under the bridge over the Chicago River on Foster, there for a long time just this summer was like a very large, it was one or two people homeless encampment under Foster. And when you would run on that path, you would always see that on the other side of the river. And it would, there's more and more junk kind of there, and it was becoming more and more of a nuisance. And you're if you're like a young guy like me, just kind of running past it, it's like, oh, that's unfortunate, but it's not really an effect on your life. But then one day you run by and the entire bridge is a blackened char because the entire thing caught on fire.
And that was a serious problem for the infrastructure on Foster and just the safety. That's right next to a school. That's right next to all sorts of traffic. Like, that's really, really dangerous. And that's not a compassionate approach to allow people to do that. So I think two things Chicago can do: make it much easier to experiment with different kinds of housing availability, which we do not do a good job of in Chicago, and have a zero tolerance policy for that, because it's not actually compassionate. You see this in Humboldt Park. Humboldt Park has been for a long time now, it's just de facto that you're going to have tons and tons and tons of tents in Humboldt Park. And that's just not fair to the community, and it's not safe.
Yeah, de facto. It doesn't have to be that way. This is more than an annoyance, but I did want to talk about the Axios brackets about annoying intersections. Or what was it that Axios put up, Eric? You guys all have the – in fact, my producer Iridian today gave me the story about this.
Well, Axios put out a call to its readers, Axios Chicago, a newsletter written by Justin Kaufman, Monica Eng, and Harry Shepard, put out a call to their readers asking, what are the most annoying intersections in Chicago? And they didn't really specify what annoying intersections mean, but you can tell by what happened. They got 16 of them and did a bracket tournament. And on Wednesday, the semifinalists were Armitage, Ashland, Elston. And for those of you who don't live in the city, this is going to mean nothing. But for those of us who live on the north side, we will know all these intersections. It was Armitage, Ashland, Elston versus Fullerton, Halstead, and Lincoln. Fullerton, Halstead, Lincoln is a fairly ordinary intersection. They're all six-corner intersections. And Armitage, Ashland, Elston is, according to Justin Kaufman, who texted me a little bit ago, is going to be in the finals. And that's a very strange little intersection on the northwest side. And my finalist was Diversey, Damon, Clybourne, if you can picture that, against North Damon and Milwaukee, which is where the Damon stop is on the blue line. And right now, the North Damon and Milwaukee is leading. And I will throw those intersections out to the panel to see which ones you think. Between Armitage, Ashland, and Elston versus North Damon and Milwaukee, which one do you choose?
I'm more familiar with North Damon and Milwaukee, so I'll just vote for that one. But the worst intersections to me are out in the suburbs. But I'll let the panel chime in here. Marge, which of those is most bothersome to you?
I vote for that one, too, because it backs up to the highway exit sometimes. And that really snarls traffic for a lot more than the intersection. I just find it kind of funny that these are all six-corner intersections. Like, we're so used to the grid here that, like, whoa, I got to turn on an angle. I don't know how to do that. And it wrecks up the whole corner. Is that really our problem, that we're just, you can make a right, you can make a left, but these angle things, we don't know how
to do it. Whose idea was it to have diagonal streets, damn it?
Says the girl who grew up in Detroit, where, you know, the main streets are like the spokes of a wheel. We got a different kind of setup over there.
Well, and of course, some of them, you have like no left turn on some of the streets. So you can't go from one street to the other because of the six corner element. It would totally clog up traffic. Marge, I want to challenge you. You said that North Damon and Milwaukee backs up to the interstate. It's pretty far.
Am I picturing the Diversey Damon?
You could be picturing the Elston Ashland, right? Wasn't that one that we
Elston,
said?
Elston, Ashland, and Armitage is very close to the Kennedy, and that does happen there. Anyway, I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, I think I was picturing Diversey and Damon. The Elston, Ashland also backs up, but you get that little, if you're going north, you can turn on that Bobien or that little side street, and you don't have to go into the intersection.
Austin, if you had to pedal your bicycle through some of these things, that must be terrifying.
For sure. I like the Milwaukee Damon North intersection. I think it's charming and interesting and cool, and you've got good stuff. There's subterraneans there. The Roby Hotel is there. Dove's Luncheonette is there. Big Star is there. Like, there's stuff going on. It's pretty. It's like kind of, you know, it's unique
and vibrant.
And there's the most beautiful. That was where the most beautiful Walgreens in the world was forever. You know, that old bank.
Right.
No, rest in peace to that Walgreens. So that one's fine. I would actually. If we're like ranking top intersections, in fact, I would put it there. It's definitely not near the bottom. The one, the Elston Ashland is redeemed by having, you know, a nice grocery store there. Horween Leather is there, which is a very unique Chicago, leather company that's been there for a really, really long time and is a cool business. As Marge said, there's ways to kind of get around that area very easily to avoid that. So I'm cool with that. I think the worst, a way worse north side intersection by far than any of the ones mentioned is Lincoln and Ashland and Belmont, where that Whole Foods is. Mm-hmm. And that was always by far the worst to bike in. And what's most annoying about it, it's basically a six-way intersection with a massive, just open no man's land in the middle. So it's really scary to bike on, and drivers are often very unsure. And the most annoying thing about it is they took a year to reimagine it and redo it. And I'm like, great, I finally won't feel like, you know, totally exposed on this intersection. And it's exactly the same as before. They made the turning like a little bit different, but it's still like very scary to bike on. I would say that is my least favorite in the city.
What struck me was that only a few south side intersections even got into the competition. And this is one of those incredibly rare situations where I think it was completely right for the south side to lose to the north side. Our traffic is just nowhere near as bad. And I think we don't have nearly as many diagonal streets. We really just have a couple of real major diagonal streets. Even the ones that made this list, 79th and Stony, which is where the Skyway ramp originates, mm-hmm. and 130th and Torrance, they're actually not that bad. When I was a kid, for why we were late getting to my grandparents' house, we got caught by a train. No matter what, we got caught by a train. But they've completely redone the entire intersection so that it's an over and under thing, and you can't get held up anymore.
I want to say that Lincoln, Belmont, and Ashland, which Austin loathes, it has the benefit of being like six severely defined corners. I mean, and it's a large intersection. The reason that I think that Armitage, Ashland, and Elston should win this going away is that it's kind of a phony six corners. It was somehow they laid out the city in a way that these streets didn't exactly come together in a six corner configuration. So you've got this weird little island in the middle.
Right.
And you've got a really short spot where you've got to turn. Anyone who's ever tried to make their way around there, I mean, once you know your way around that intersection, it's okay. And I used to live over there, so it's not unfamiliar to me. But I think that is one of the most annoying intersections in the city. I'm rooting for that big time, and I'm urging all Mincing Rascals listeners to go to Axios Chicago tomorrow or on Thursday and vote for Armitage, Ashland, and Elston.
You know, we raised our kids, or at least through junior high and high school, out in LaGrange Park. They went to Lyons Township High School. We weren't that far then from Oakbrook Terrace and some of those suburbs. And a lot of those people are afraid to drive into Chicago because of the traffic. It's just too scary. And I'm thinking, if you can drive around Oakbrook Mall and Butterfield Road and Cermak and Route 83, where they have the speed light cameras on, and, you know, it's just like nobody anticipated the growth and nobody seemed to give a damn. So they just started making roads and lanes and stuff. And it's nuts. That, to me, is like, if you can navigate that, you can navigate anything.
Visually, soul-sucking and depressing.
Absolutely.
Way more than any Chicago. Like, even that Elston intersection, there's some character. Like, I saw that. I saw something felt like a movie filming there one time in that alley, like on the east side of that intersection. Like, you can film stuff there. You cannot film anything at that Oakbrook Terrace like intersection, besides like if you're a red light camera, you know, charging people a bunch of money.
Yeah.
It's so depressing. Those like 50 lane huge intersections right next to the mall are just sad.
And these parking lots that you really can't get to from the direction or lane you're in. We were going, if you go up Route 59 around Yorktown or Plainfield, you have these like four or five lanes north, four or five lanes south, with massive parking lots on either side. And then off in the distance, there's a Popeyes or a Home Depot. And you just think, I do not want to live here. This is this is so character. And I'm sure some of you listening to this live there and you're having rich lives, and I'm happy for you. But as a visitor to your planet, I'm depressed when I go through there.
And I don't think you're boosting your ratings, John.
This is not helping the ratings for the Mincing Rascals.
I don't think so. You're cutting off the Oakbrook residents. Be careful.
I think they know.
Once you get off of those streets, then, of course, the communities are lovely. But
yes, that's it. Behind their little Gates that's yeah. great out there.
But you're right, though, about it being crazy to drive around there, especially like you mentioned on Butterfield Road and on around Oak Brook Mall. Those are like mini expressways everywhere. If you can handle mini expressways, you can handle a six corner intersection in Chicago. So they, I would say, listeners, don't be afraid.
Nobody rides their bicycle, Austin, through those streets. There's this, and literally they don't. There's no way. You couldn't do it. Eric, you were going to say what?
Oh, I was going to say, John, this is an opportunity for WGN to run a worst suburban intersection
bracket
contest, bracket competition, and show Axios how it's done.
I would also like to see a best intersection. Maybe next week.
Most charming, most beautiful, most that's the one you're interested in.
I didn't know that leather shops were going to figure into this conversation.
Cool. I think it's the only one in America that does this very special leather called Cordovan leather or something like that. You guys might know it better than me, but it's like a very cool look up. It's called Horween leather. It's on that intersection. It's like a whole amazing family business that does cool.
What streets are you talking about again there, Austin?
It's the Ashland Elston craziness. Yeah. It's right there and right on that weird. It's on the river, I think.
Austin, while you got the microphone for a second, you've been, as well as any of us, keeping track of the school board and school funding and school closings issues. Let's just wrap this up with a quick summary. We spent a lot of time the last two podcasts on that. Any postscripts to where those stories are?
I would only mention that the two things I will bring up. One is that there was a lot of chatter over the weekend from a lot of good sources saying that there was imminent departures from the school board, which makes sense. That is a position that's come under a ton of fire, both from the CTU saying that they should fire Pedro Martinez and the mayor saying you should issue this $300 million payday loan. And meanwhile, you have people on the other side saying, hey, school board members, you need to protect these people and not do these loans. And I think a lot of people on the board are simply saying, this is a no-win for me. I'm leaving. I'm resigning. I still think we could expect to see that soon. The second thing that I will put in just a long, long, long list of horrible communications errors from the Brandon Johnson administration is that when asked by the Chicago Tribune's Jake Sheridan whether he told Pedro Martinez to resign, Brandon Johnson said, I didn't tell anyone to do anything, or I didn't ask anyone to do anything, which this is after 2 weeks of people saying Brandon Johnson, WBEZ reporting Brandon Johnson asked Pedro to resign. Pedro Martinez writing an op-ed saying Brandon Johnson asked me to resign. Don't you think at some point in those 2 weeks you would say this is wrong, this is misinformation, one? And two, he always says his cop-out on all this stuff is, I don't discuss personnel issues, which he did discuss by saying, I didn't tell this person to resign, which is a straight-up lie. And he knows it's a lie.
Do you think he was being Clinton-esque about that? Yeah. That is, maybe he had his first assistant tell him to resign. I just wonder if he was obfuscating.
Oh, that would be way too cute by half to suggest that he dispatched someone to ask him to resign. In fact, Martinez's op-ed specifically said that it was on September 18th, hours after a meeting. It was a direct sentence. Brandon Johnson asked me to resign. Maybe he didn't. But if he didn't, then you'd think Johnson would or somebody would have put out a statement the next day saying, no, this isn't happening. It does not have the ring of truth, if I may be mild in my expression here of doubt. And it's just one of these unforced errors, another rake that Johnson has stepped on for no reason. I mean, he's got to own it. If he asked Martinez to resign, he's got to own it. And if he didn't, he should have come out and said right away, no, I'm not asking him to resign. This is just, anyone want to make excuses for him?
No?
Class, Bueller.
No, but I will say this makes me increasingly nervous about the school board elections. You know, they're so under the radar. We don't have a consequential election here in Illinois. I know we have a major presidential race, but it's not so controversial here in Illinois, and we have some congressional races to watch. But for the most part, it's going to be kind of a low turnout election, I think, in Illinois. And at the bottom, well, not even the bottom, right? The school board elections are somehow intermingled on the ballot with
I think it's the very
judge. Aren't they the like the re- the retention, then the school, then some other section of judges. I have to look at the ballot, but I read somewhere that it was sort of intermingled in there somehow. But at any rate, it looks increasingly, thanks to the reporting of the aforementioned BEZ and Sun-Times, it looks like the money pouring into those races is either from CTU endorsing candidates or charter school folks, some of them out of state, pouring money in to their candidates. And it's a grim choice for us. Where will those candidates stand if pressed by the mayor? Of course, they won't be a majority. The mayor will still have the majority. A 21-member school board is just a bad idea from the outset.
Well,
and the composition is even worse.
Well, Austin's not going to have any trouble voting, that's for sure.
You're going.
If people would like to see, if you search just Illinois Policy School Board Candidate Guide, we listed every single candidate, sent surveys to every single candidate, and you can see it's a very, very simple. It's not comprehensive on education policy. It's very simple. It's the CTU question. Are they going to be on both sides of the bargaining table? So it shows every single candidate. Did they take CTU money? Are they endorsed by CTU? Have they pledged to reject money from CTU? That's all it is. So if you're curious about that information, you can see it there. I will also shout out something to look up, which is the clip of Michael Scott in The Office where he's on the phone and he says, I want to fire him. And the guy on the phone goes, Michael, you have to have cause. And he goes, because I hate him. And that's what I think of. Brandon Johnson and Pedro Martinez.
But is it simple enough then, Austin, that if they took money from the Chicago Teachers Union, they should not be on the Chicago Public School
Immediate
Board?
Immediate disqualification.
Why?
If there's a red line that could be drawn that is evidenced by the last 18 months on education policy, it is that you should be disqualified from serving in a position of authority over the schools if you are funded by the CTU. The evidence, I think, is clear over the last 18 months why that's a problem.
In principle or just in practice?
It dooms us to the candidates who want to decimate the public schools with vouchers that cream off the people who can go to private schools instead. Yeah. I know you don't agree with me on that, Austin.
Austin's smiling about that. No, I predicted this when we first started talking about elected school boards. I said, everyone thinks this is going to be a great thing, but it's going to be a poop show because you're going to have millions and millions of dollars spent on either side from people who are staunch advocates of privatization, school choice, however you want to call it. And then you've got the people in the unions side funding candidates and you've got these positions that I don't think anybody here, I mean, certainly I could not name anybody on the school board itself. I now know the name or have read the name of the chairman of the board, and of course the CEO is Martinez, but these are obscure positions, and I can see these people who are on the board now going, wait a minute, this is turning into a big to-do. I wanted to, you know, have a little prestige and be because it's a volunteer position and there's not a whole lot of prestige in it. I can understand them saying, hey, I want out of this. I don't want to just be sitting here so that I can dance to the mayor's tune. That's not why I got involved in this. I don't have any say in education policy. I'm just supposed to say yes, sir, when the mayor says he wants a vote. So I can imagine people just resigning, saying, heck with this. I'll sit it out and let the elected people figure it out.
It seems pretty likely, considering the fact that most of these appointees are political novices. They're people who are not used to this kind of incredible unpleasantness. And as you pointed out, Eric, they're just volunteering. So they apparently did not know what they were signing up for. And it sounds like perhaps the pressure being put on them to potentially resign if they're not willing to go along with Mayor Johnson's wishes to fire Pedro Martinez. Sounds like that pressure might be very real, considering that Governor Pritzker felt the need to make the comment that he hopes nobody will quit, that he feels that they should all stay in place.
Yeah.
If only for the continuity during these negotiations.
I have a quick process question, and that is, Martinez is against taking out this payday loan to cover the cost of the new contract. If the board, the board has to go along with him either way, is that correct, Austin? That it's not up to Martinez alone.
No, he could say the loan's awesome, and the board could say no. He could say the loan stinks, and the board could say yes. It's ultimately the board's decision on this borrowing. The simple
But the problem is, from a narrative perspective, it's almost like Larry Snelling and ShotSpotter, right? It's like, well, you don't want the CEO saying this is a bad move, because then, you know, we're going against his wishes. So ultimately, the board could pass this loan, whether Martinez agrees with it or not.
We will continue to follow that and other stories of national and local significance. That's all the time we're taking today. Thanks for dialing into the Mincing Rascals, featuring today Kate Plies and Marge Halperin, Austin Berg, and Eric Zorn. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson, Pete Zimmerman, and this week, Iridian Fierro. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Really groovy, kids.
That was
well
good.
Done.
I really, Kate, thanks for the intersection idea. That was really
That's good.
And a little change of pace. And,
thanks, Axio Chicago.
Yeah, those good folks. All right. See you guys next week.
Adios,
campers.
All right.
Good job.
Bye,
see you,
everybody. Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.